So in the last segment, we talked about bias and variance. And we mentioned that interviewers can contribute to both of these. And so in this segment, we'll explain a little bit more why that can be and how this comes about. And to understand what's going on in the interviewing process, it's helpful to review standardized interviewing techniques. And in the next segment, we will talk about more conversational interviewing techniques. So in survey research, the goal is usually to standardize so that each respondent is exposed to the same question experience and that the recording of the answer is the same too. So two people giving the same answer should be recorded in the same way. If that's the case, so Jack Fowler and Mangioni mentioned in their book, Standardized Survey Interviewing, then the differences in the answers can be correctly interpreted as reflecting differences between respondents rather than between the process that produced these answers. So that's really the spirit and has been implemented quite well since then in many surveys that are done here in the US and elsewhere. Now, the assumption behind that, though, is that the interviewers adequately fulfill their role. So they have to be carefully trained and have to understand that this is the process that should be used in order to collect these answers. It also assumes that the wording of each question is a complete and an adequate script of what should be asked, so that the respondents, when they hear or read the question, will be fully prepared to answer. Some guidelines for standardized interviewing might be important. Questions should be read exactly as worded. Probing should only be done in non-directive ways. What you often see happening in standardized interviews is that the respondent asks something to the interviewer, and then the usual response of the interviewer is, whatever it means to you. And that, of course, can cause a little bit of frustration, but it is definitely a way to respond that does not influence the respondent. Often, what you see as strategy is that interviewers just reread the question or reread the answer categories, or they make sure that the respondent, in fact, picks an answer category that is provided to him or her. Whatever the interviewer records as an answer should reflect what the respondent says, and they should not provide any personal information that might imply a particular value or preference with respect to the topic to be covered in the survey. And finally, no feedback should be given to the respondent. Let me play you now a few examples of a standardized questionnaire sequence.
Now I'd like to ask you some questions specific to your diet. For the next group of questions, I'll ask you how much you favor or oppose engaging in certain behaviors. After I say the behavior, please say one of the following: strongly favor, somewhat favor, neither favor nor oppose, somewhat oppose, or strongly oppose. The first behavior, avoiding fast food.
Strongly favor. Mm-hmm.
Now I'd like to ask you some questions specific to your diet. For the next group of questions, I'll ask you how much you favor or oppose engaging in certain behaviors. After I say the behavior, please say one of the following: strongly favor, somewhat favor, neither favor nor oppose, somewhat oppose, or strongly oppose. The first behavior, avoiding fast food.
Avoiding what? I'm sorry.
Avoiding fast food.
Oh, avoiding fast food. Somewhat.
Somewhat, thank you. Oh, one moment, let me just be clear. To be more specific, the choices are strongly favor, somewhat favor, neither favor nor oppose, somewhat oppose, or strongly oppose.
Yeah, I somewhat favor somewhat avoiding favor. Fast food.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Okay. I'm not strongly opposed to avoiding fast food, which would insinuate that I eat fast food all the time, correct?
Oh, whatever it means to you.
I mean, I just want to be clear on the language that I'm using to define what, you know.
So just for clarification, you did say somewhat favor, correct?
Do I somewhat favor fast food?
No, avoid, no. Not somewhat, okay. Favor, somewhat favor avoiding fast food.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, I knew there was like a negative in there, so I favor that.
Thank you.
So these audio snippets give you an idea, and you also heard some breakdowns in the conversational process. Certainly questions for clarifications, but also not exactly reading as scripted is something we noticed in these audio files. Let's look at one example question. Here's a question that is commonly asked in victimization surveys, and it is a very general question. You find it also in other surveys to measure fear of crime in general. The General Social Survey, for example, is a survey that fields this question. Is there any area around here that is within a mile where you would be afraid to walk around at night? Now, this is a hard question. You can imagine respondents don't necessarily have an answer to this question in their head. You might not be able to visualize the area within a mile. You might not walk there at night to begin with. So do you really know how you're afraid you are when you walk around there at night? But it gets sort of at the spirit of crime and victimization. These crime and victimization surveys, they have a lot of questions on that nature. They can be sensitive. Respondents might not want to answer the question to an interviewer, honestly. They can be vague. We discussed in prior segments already some of those wordings that can be problematic. So for these reasons, we conducted a survey to measure the effect of interviewers on the respondent. And I should warn you a little bit, this segment is a little bit more statistical than what we otherwise look at, but I think it is important background information for you to get a sense of the nature of these interview effects. So in this study, which was launched in 2001, in Germany, we were able to run four surveys with the random probability sample and one survey, a quarter survey, independently by five institutes. Two of these random probability surveys were face-to-face surveys, one was conducted on the phone, and one was a mail survey. Each of these four surveys have been launched in the same sampling points, meaning the same areas, small confined areas, could be small village or just a few city blocks in which the cases are sampled. And we had 160 of these sampling points, and a random subset of addresses in each of these sampling points went to each of these surveys that I just mentioned. After picking the sampling points, there was a random walk conducted where every third household was noted, and leading up to 110 addresses, and those, as I said, were randomly assigned to the four surveys. And then within each household, a respondent was randomly selected. Now, why is this study of interest in this question and design context? With the fear of crime question that I mentioned to you before, one would assume to see some effects of the sampling point themselves, meaning people who live in the same geographic area, in the same neighborhood, they might answer this question quite similarly. After all, if this is a quote-unquote dangerous neighborhood, we would expect people to react to that. Other questions in that survey were directly related to the neighborhood, for example, distance to the next train station or other community measures. In general, in survey research, we do know that people that live in the same sampling point answer more similarly to each other than people would if they were randomly selected from the entire population. We call this design effect in surveys, or clustering effect, and they have the unfortunate side effect that it reduces your effective sample size. Imagine if you pick two people and they answer exactly the same thing. It's the same amount of information as having asked only one person, right? So these cluster effects are usually unavoidable for financial reasons, because we can't have interviewers travel all around the United States. So it is advisable to pick certain areas in which the sampling is done. But also, there are no lists in many countries from which one could easily draw a random sample. So the effort to first list all possible housing units and addresses and then pick cases would be too hard. So assuming that you are in a context of cluster samples and you have these sampling points, in most surveys, you have an interviewer then working in this one area. And so it's really hard for normal face-to-face surveys to disentangle the effect that an interviewer has on the answers from the respondent and the effect that comes from the neighborhood itself. That's why we conducted this study. So in this study, because we had four surveys, and in particular two face-to-face surveys within each sampling point, we are able to disentangle the homogenizing effect of an interviewer to the answers of the respondent and of the sampling point itself. So if you were to write this out, we have an overall variance that we observe for our question in three components: the sampling point, the geographic area, the interviewer. Together, they form the cluster variance that we observe in the study. And then there is the respondent themselves, the portion of the variant that lies in all the respondents themselves. So this is the goal here of this survey and provides us an opportunity to disentangle area and interview and get a sense of the magnitude of the interviewer effect on the variance component in face-to-face surveys. Very few studies have been done to disentangle these two effects. They are costly and it's often hard to find funding for these kind of endeavors. Cuomo Murchiter and Pam Campanelli have done a study of this nature in Great Britain. Very interesting pieces to read. And there had been a few surveys on interview effects, of variance component interview effects, but mostly with telephone surveys. We have those in the literature that is on the course website. Now, with these variance components, we can compute what is called rho, the intra-class correlation coefficient. That's what you see down here. These are the same variance component we talked about before, the overall cluster variance in the denominator and cluster variance plus respondent variance in the denominator. So this rho, the interclass correlation coefficient, goes into this equation that forms a measure of the design effect. The general formula for the design effect does not have the square root here, so we talk about deft as 1 plus rho, the interclass correlation coefficient, and W minus 1, where W is the cluster size. And, you know, ideally the clusters are all of similar size. This gets a little bit more complicated when you have different cluster sizes or differential non-response. We'll not talk about that here in this class. This I personally like the square root of the design effect as a measure for the design effect because it's intuitive. Really related to the inflation of the confidence intervals, but either one works. So what you can sort of think of as a rule of thumb, if you have a design effect of 2, you know, that inflates your variance on that amount and that translates to a deft of 1.4. Okay, so let's look at the results of this survey. Now, we have down here on our design effect measure from 1 to 3. 3 is very large. 1 is small, obviously. 1 would mean there is no effect, there's no inflation going on. Each of these dots is one of the survey items. So the survey had about 110 items, and we computed design effect for each of them. And you see they spread all across here. And what is missing from this, the y-axis is the fraction of the interviewer proportion on the design effect over the overall design effect. So a value of 1 means that the entire amount of deft that I see here is attributable to the interviewer. Whereas if it's 0, that means it's only the area effect that we see here. A little scary because most of the items in this particular survey are in the upper part. If you use that same measure and look at the fraction of the total cluster variance due to the interviewer, so the portion that we had on the y-axis just now in the graph before, and look at the distribution of items by sensitivity of the item, whether the item is a factual question or a non-factual question, whether it's closed or open, and whether it's difficult or easy to answer, then we see that the interviewer portions of the cluster variance are somewhat higher in sensitive questions. No difference really on whether this is factual or non-factual, but higher in open questions and no real difference between easy and difficult. There have been many papers trying to classify and see what real question type will sort of form larger interview effects, but somewhat inconclusive results on this one here. But if you take them all together, if you think that each of these things, whether it's non-factual, whether it's sensitive, whether it's open, and whether it's a difficult question, these are all harmful item properties, and we group the fraction of the interviewer proportion on the design effect by these harmful item properties, then we do see that the proportion of interview effects on the cluster variance goes up as we add these harmful item properties. I mentioned earlier that we have male surveys in this study as well. And so what you see here is a plot where the design effect for each item in the male survey on the y-axis is plotted against the design effect on the face-to-face survey on the x-axis. And even so, the male survey was just as clustered as the face-to-face surveys were, you see that the design effects are much larger and therefore to the right of the diagonal in both of these face-to-face surveys compared to the male survey. So that's a strong argument and a strong empirical evidence that we have interviewer effects in addition to the sampling point effect in these face-to-face surveys and of a sizable amount. Additional reasons for interviewer effects are, for example, hidden screening question, unclear terms where the interviewer vary in how they explain these terms, unclear response expectation, or answers that are coded on the fly by the interviewer. But in particular, the issue of unclear terms and probing and getting at the right understanding of the question is something that can contribute to these interview effects. And that's one of the reasons why an alternative interviewing technique is often discussed under the label conversational interviewing. That's what we'll be talking about in the next segment.